Okay, can you introduce yourselves?
I'm Cash Nguyen.
Courtney Hansen. Kathy Teague. And we all three work in an organization in Santa Cruz called Seen About Us.
And can you describe me what Seen About Us does, what kind of work it does?
Yeah, well, just some background on the organization, because it's fairly new. We started in the summer of 2012, and it began as a sort of reading group. A handful of people who met regularly because of our politics around prisons and abolition. And then as we noticed that folks were regularly dying in the county jail here, we decided we really needed to get organized. So we describe ourselves as a community-based group working to build coalitions to eradicate the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, and Seen About Us means without prison bars. Some of us have been inside for brief periods of time. Some people have parents who've been inside. Many of us have been impacted. And we kind of try to have forums and discussions where political education occurs, but does bring people together.
Great, thank you. So currently, California locks up more of its residents than many sovereign nations do, and kind of what we're interested in sharing here at Radio Autonomía with folks is what's at stake for folks locally or within the state in itself when we continue to let the state expand prisons on the basis of, or this excuse of creating jobs or keeping communities safe?
Well, for one, I think that makes us forget that the prison system perpetuates and relies on poverty. So the rhetoric of job creation really distracts us from understanding that we live under an economic system where jobs will never be secure if things really continue this way.
Also, the excuse or the reasoning that prisons will create jobs is really insidious, because it is, as Courtney said, a distraction. Non-punitive alternatives to prisons create a lot of jobs. It also distracts from the idea that we need to put jobs in communities. Mm-hmm. And create resource centers for people so that they can avoid incarceration and we can decarcerate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what is at stake is the access to creation of privileges and life chances that are privileges that serve in determining the distribution of life chances. That often offer some individuals degrees of buffering from violences faced, especially by people of color, those with disabilities, immigrants, indigenous peoples, prisoners, foster youth, homeless people. Like Courtney said, people who are in poverty, a big example of that that we're hearing with these California bills, AB 109, and counties using money to expand their jails and prisons. What we're really seeing is this thing that people are saying, the school to prison pipeline, this really disturbing national trend wherein children are being funneled out of public schools and into juvenile and criminal justice systems. Many of these children have disabilities or histories of poverty, abuse, or neglect, and these would benefit from additional educational and counseling services. Instead, they're being isolated and punished and pushed out. We also have these things called zero tolerance policies that criminalize minor infraction of school rules. So you see not only adults, but you also see children disappearing, and that's what is also at stake. Instead of building new jails, why don't we put that money into building drug treatment centers or centers for the mentally ill outside of these cages?
So I think why we talk about the distribution of life chances is that because of colonialism and capitalism, especially global capitalism, life chances are something that are distributed along many different lines of race and class and gender, nationality, sexuality. And what the prison system really teaches us through media, politicians, shows like Cops and Law and Order, is that people who end up in prison, just people, they had a set of choices and they picked the wrong one and now they're paying the price. So our work really likes to look at the social and economic reasons and the context of people's lives and how they get funneled into the prison system. And not in such an individualized manner that, oh, there's good people and bad people, because we know that's not true. But kind of deconstructing crime and really holistically looking at how people get pushed in that direction.
So does this go along with that notion of being more vulnerable that Ruthie Wilson Gilmore claims that certain populations are become or are made more vulnerable to premature death?
Yeah, I think it definitely does. There's a lot of different words that folks are using to describe it, like premature death, slow death. Dean Spade talks about this a lot from the perspective of critical trans politics. Yeah, I think those are very, very related.
And speaking of trans politics and in the analysis of, that Dean Spade brings around gender, we hardly hear about incarcerated women when discussing the prison industrial complex. And yet there are the number of women in prison has dramatically increased at nearly 1.5 times the rate of men. And mm-hmm. I know that Sim Barras has had discussions around that. And can you share a little bit about some of the discussions and conversations that you all have had in regards to women in prisons?
Yeah, I mean, I think we often catch those fleeting glimpses of statistics and how women are, I think, like somewhere between 6 to 8% now of the prison population, and 2/3 of them are mothers. And we also hear skewed details via the news or reality crime shows like Cops, but rarely are the stories of the incarcerated truly told, and nowhere is this really truer than with women. Although they do remain a relatively small fraction of the incarcerated, women's prison population has exploded in the recent years, and the captured, much like male counterparts, are like young, poor women of color. And to work with women, like, and for a woman to survive upon the violence and degradation, one must really have to organize at the intersections of both race, class, and gender to build a community of resistance amidst the most alienating circumstances. And this in itself shatters the myths of female passivity and preconceptions of what resistance really looks like. I know Kati was had something to say about like sexual violence.
Yeah, when I think about women in prison, I think about gendered violence, particularly the issue of rape, and how women may theoretically have less recourse than men because the violence that they experience is very much more likely to be at the hands of a guard than, say, another prisoner. That's speculation. But it also just reinforces the violence that we experience as women outside of the prison and makes it more acceptable and more normalized. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And also I was thinking a lot about how women who fight their attackers, their sexual attackers or their physical abusers, are often incarcerated for fighting back. That affects women differently than it does men. So it just perpetuates the control that we experience in society in general, fighting back against violence, against sexual violence. Who gets locked up is very much determined by, the way people want to maintain the status quo
and society, and of course, disproportionately will always affect poor people of color.
Yeah, and I think that kind of the common thread as far as against women and violence against trans people is sort of the, like, punishment for survival. So Dean Spade talks a lot about how trans people are pushed because of discrimination and employment into these economies that are already criminalized, whether that involves like sex work or drugs. And then they're sort of hyper-criminalized because of being gender nonconforming and doing something that is actually against the law. And get funneled into the prison system. And something that I think is always really important to remember is to articulate the violence that women specifically face and female-bodied people, but also to remember that while we are told we have men and men's prisons aren't filled with men, and women's prisons aren't simply filled with women. And I think the prison really acts as a sort of apparatus that polices people's genders into a violent binary in the first place. And just like a really straightforward example of that is when I was arrested with someone who was trans, they were immediately placed into solitary confinement for the few days that we were there, despite their request to be, you know, with particular body people that they felt safe with, which comes back to the state using its own definitions of safety to criminalize and punish entire populations of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that definitely this connection of like state violence against women and like trans individuals are things that we see connections with, just not in the state of California, but like in Abu Ghraib, in Guantanamo, the way in which we take strip searches and cavity searches for granted. And, you know, the work that's seen Baras, like, recently, we got invigorated at the Chowchilla Freedom Rally, where this woman's prison is overcrowded at almost 200%. And women prisoners are the ones who get also like least visits as well. And so there's so many issues surrounding like treatment, medical attention, support, and like violence around this issue.
You were speaking of the Chowchilla demonstration. There is a upcoming prisoner hunger strike that you all are very well aware of, and demonstrations are happening all over to support that in Humboldt County, the Corcoran State Prison, and in the Bay Area, in different sites. So are you all doing anything in preparation for the upcoming prisoner hunger strikes? And also, how do you see these connections between the work that Sin Barras does and the issues raised by the striking prisoners?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And I think it's really important to talk about these upcoming hunger strikes, especially amongst, you know, it's not always the most positive topic to kind of articulate all the different ways in which prisons sort of distribute violence through our communities, but I think the prison's really a place of resistance, and that's what these hunger strikes are kind of a testimony to, is the will to survive and fight for freedom under any circumstances. And we are going to be having an event on July 7th, which is the day before the hunger strike begins here in Santa Cruz. And the purpose is to educate the community and give them some context for the strike and the prisoners' five core demands that they're fighting to win, and also to mobilize carpools to go up to Corcoran on July 13th to join the rally out front of the prison. So some of the things that this is going to entail is I've been writing a few prisoners inside the SHU, so we're going to read some excerpts from their writings because they really, better than anyone else, articulate what's going on and why we need to stop it. We're going to have some short film screenings and discussions, And then come together and make some signs and banners for folks that are going to Corcoran, and so those who aren't able to make it can communicate their message, and we can bring that with us.
It's gonna be dope.
Great. So if folks are interested in getting involved with Simbaras, what are the ways in which they can get plugged in?
Well, we definitely have a website and Facebook page. I think, you know, it's always best to get well acquainted with a group, like, over the internet. So, yeah, our website is www.sinbaras.wordpress.com, and Sinbaras is sinbaras.wordpress.com. You can write letters to us if you like to write, if you like to draw, if you like to make zines, if you've been impacted or by the prison system in any way. We would love to talk to you and hang out with you. Yeah, I'd say like the most immediate way to get plugged in is to come to the Resource Center for Nonviolence. I think it's on Sunday from 2 to 5. To get up to date on what's happening with the hunger strike, and we always have stuff going on.
And we finally solidified a real meeting space, a public meeting space, where we'll be able to hold weekly meetings. So it is true that public space on a very rare occasion is actually accessible and doesn't cost a fortune, and we'll be working with houseless folks and helping cook meals rather than paying for it. So we're definitely working on making this group grow, so it'd be great to get in touch with folks.
Yeah, I'd say stay up to date on our Facebook page and our website.
We'll have those links on our site as well. And the site has a lot of resources as well, right?
Yeah, we've got zines. We've got a zine that we made in March. We've got some resources from the ACLU and news that should be more up to date, but we'll work on updating that.
Yeah, and another thing that's on there is kind of points of unity or objectives that we came up with. So just, you know, more about our politics that we maybe didn't have time to get into here today, and sort of why we're coming at this issue through the lens of abolition rather than reform. So if folks want resources on that, the website's a great place for it.
Just educate, organize, and mobilize as hard as you can.